From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Jeffrey Kluger, who has just written a space thriller entitled Holdout. Kluger is the editor-at-large for Time magazine and the author or co-author of 12 books, including Apollo 13. He has written more than 40 cover stories for Time on topics ranging from space to human behavior, climate, medicine, and he won an Emmy for the web series A Year in Space. This morning's conversation was a few days ago, and John Wells talked to Jeffrey Kluger. Here it is now.
Kluger, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and we rarely cover fictional books on Cool Science Radio, but we wanted to have you on because the science plays such a major role driving the story, is so well researched. It takes us not only on the International Space Station, but to the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center, the Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, and Moscow Mission Control, all locations that you visited. So maybe we can start with your unique beginning to this novel. Wally Beckwith refuses to abandon her post at the space station after an accident that forces her fellow astronauts to evacuate. How did this storyline come together?
Well, the initial premise, a good friend of mine called it, and she didn't mean this disparagingly, she called it a post-it note idea, the kind of idea you can write out in 4 or 5 words, but that is evocative enough to lend itself to telling a whole story. And the premise was an astronaut who refuses to come home. That's it. That's all I had. And I found the idea fascinating. What could an astronaut do? What would an astronaut do who refused to leave space when his or her rotation was up aboard the space station? And what possible justification could there be for such a profound act of insubordination? So coming up with the premise for the of the idea, or coming up with the premise, was relatively simple. Coming up with a reason that she wouldn't leave was a little bit harder. The animating idea, the accident aboard the International Space Station that forces the rest of the crew to evacuate and leaves Wally behind when she refuses to go, was based on an actual collision that took place in space in 1997 between a Russian Progress cargo vessel and what was then the Mir space station, the Soviet Union's Mir space station, which has since been deorbited. I wrote that cover story about that accident in 1997 for Time. So that became sort of the inciting incident in the book that got the sort of story engine moving.
Yes, exactly. And then as the story progresses, she had a pretty good reason for staying on board, and she captured the attention of the world with that reason. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Her reason for staying on board is to protest and mobilize the world to intervene in what is being called in the book the consolidation. And the consolidation was a move in the story by the fictional president of Brazil to consolidate all of the interests in the Brazilian rainforest in the Amazon to sort of turbocharge the clear cutting of the forest for conversion to ranch land, the construction of hydroelectric dams and mining within the rainforest. And in so doing, the president also engages in an act of not quite ethnic cleansing, because there aren't killings going on, but he's dispersing and relocating the indigenous tribes in the rainforest. And there are about 1 million indigenous people in the rainforest, representing about 300 remaining tribes. And in the storyline, he is seeking to dislocate and relocate all of them to internment camps. and Wally Beckwith, the lead character's justification for staying aboard the station, is to lead a global movement to encourage an intervention. In this case, the U.S. would lead a military intervention into the rainforest to stop the consolidation.
And prior to that, they just let Brazil go off on its own. And they, there was nothing involved by our country or any other countries. I want to go back to something you said, Jeffrey, about her reluctance to leave. We have astronauts in the real world that have 3 and 4 month assignments, have 6 month assignments. We had one that 1 year assignment.
Right.
And you speak to a lot of these people. Do they have mixed feelings about leaving the International Space Station when their assignment is up?
They do have mixed feelings about leaving. I think on the one hand, like anybody else, they would and do miss their home. They miss the comforts of Earth. They miss the familiarity of Earth. They realize that there are health hazards to staying in space for too long. Zero G is very unfriendly on the human system. And there is good reason for astronauts not to stay more than 6 months, and good reason for the health of astronauts to be studied closely because of the effects that the that zero G has on the body. On the other hand, they dearly love this work. They really enjoy doing it. You know, they look forward to these long 6 month, or in a couple of cases, in Scott Kelly's case and in one other case, 1 year rotations. They very much look forward to them. They very much love the work they do when they're aloft. They very much miss the station when they're back down on Earth. And many of them, I'm thinking now particularly of an astronaut I know fairly well, Samantha Cristoforetti, who was on the space station, a European and Italian astronaut, who was on the space station, I think 6 or 7 years ago, and is going back now in just a few months. She is wildly enthusiastic about going back into space and very much looking forward to it. So I think when they do leave, they're happy to reunite with their families, and they're happy to be back in the 1G environment in which we evolved to live. But they miss their rotations in space.
Right. Apollo 7 influences your book in a couple of ways. One is Apollo 7, Wally Schirra got a pretty good head cold, and it couldn't drain because he was in zero gravity, some pressure he got, you know, and those sorts of things. He made the decision to not wear his helmet on reentry because he was afraid he was going to damage his ears and his sinuses even further. And that was perceived as a bit of a mutiny. And then the second, and so that sort of connects to your book as well, as Wally injures her ears and she knows that she can't put that helmet on because she could blow her ears right out for good. And the other way is because of this sort of insurrection, not insurrection, but to go against orders. They told her to get into the spacecraft and to come back after the accident, and she refused. Can you talk about how Apollo 7 influenced your book?
Sure. Apollo 7 was the closest thing we have ever had to a mutiny in space. It was the first flight of the Apollo spacecraft. It took place in the crew launched on October 11th, 1968, stayed aloft for 11 days. And it's important to remember that that flight took place just 20 months after the Apollo 1 fire, which happened on January 27, 1967, when three astronauts lost their lives on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral: Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. Wally Schirra was commanding the first manned mission of that spacecraft that had killed three of his friends just 20 months before. And he was determined that the mission be a very conservative one. He was determined that the mission be nothing more than what it was supposed to be, which was a shakedown cruise to make sure that the spacecraft could work well, could operate well, and most importantly, could operate safely for the 11 days of the mission, which was about the length of an average to slightly long lunar mission. So they were testing the ability of this spacecraft to operate in a lunar environment where it flew just a few months later. The mission was instead stuffed with all manner of scientific experiments that the doctors and the astronomers and other researchers on the ground wanted the crew to engage in. And typically, science experiments are done on space flights, and there's nothing wrong with filling the flight plan with work for the crew to do. But in this case, Shirov felt that his crew was being distracted from their much more important, much more fundamental work of just making sure this spacecraft operated as it should. And as a result, he and his crew followed his lead, refused to engage in a lot of the experiments that they were required to engage in. He effectively, metaphorically, tore up the flight plan and led his own flight. The other two astronauts got the same head cold Wally had. So like all of us, we are not at our best when we're feeling ill. So they were very cranky. They became very snappish and even sarcastic with the ground. And all of this took the form of what was later described quietly by NASA, because NASA didn't like to talk about this, talk about such insubordination. But it was generally described as the closest thing there has ever been to a mutiny in space. And Wally Beckwith, the lead character in the book, Wally is not her real name. Her real name is Belka. She has a Russian name. Wally names herself, takes Wally Shirov's name and uses that as her nickname because she admired him. She admired his flying skills. She admired his resolve. She admired his tenacity. And she admired his determination to do what he thought was best for his crew or his and his mission, even if it was in defiance of NASA's orders. She respected that mutiny because she felt he did what he felt was right for his crew.
Yes, and Wally Shirov was planning on retiring anyway. The other two astronauts were not, but they never flew again. I mean, that's the end of it.
That was the end of it. That's right. Chris Kraft grounded both of them, and he made it clear that as long as he was director of flight crew operations, which he remained well past the end of the Apollo program, Walt Cunningham and Don Eisley, the two other astronauts, would never fly again. And it was a real tragedy for them because their willingness to be on that first crew test flying that what was perceived as a dangerous spacecraft, put them in a very good position, teed them up for later lunar landing missions. Both of them would have almost surely walked on the moon, and instead they never flew again.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Jeffrey Kluger. He's just written a space thriller titled Holdout. Jeffrey, I wanted to ask you about this. On July 29th of this year, the International Space Station did a 1.5 somersault when Russia's module Nauka, hours earlier, had docked with the space station, and then all of a sudden it accidentally fired its thrusters. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the space station has its own thrusters, but it can also be maneuvered by any one of a number of modules that are attached to it. The SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft has its own thrusters that, if necessary, could be pressed into service maneuvering the station. Similarly, the Soyuz crew vessel, the Russian Soyuz crew vessel, similarly a Progress crew vessel, and similarly this new module, the newest module aboard the station, the Nauka module, which the Russians launched in July. Once it docked, the module misfired and threw the station out of orientation. The station wound up doing a very slow motion, 1.5 rotation as a result of this out of control thruster firing. Now, the Russians were able to power down the module's guidance system, or rather not its guidance system, its orientation system, its thruster system. They were able to power that down and the station's thrusters were able to take control. But this was, while no lives were in danger, the stability of the station was in danger. The station has to maintain a very fixed attitude, both to maintain communications with Earth and also to orient its solar panels properly toward the sun to receive enough energy to provide power to the entire facility. So it was a cause for concern. Happily, it was not something that endangered the lives of the astronauts, but an out of control space station, even one that's spinning very slowly, is one devoutly not to be wished for.
It was also scary because I understand that Moscow Mission Control was out of position for about an hour. They couldn't get involved because they didn't have the communications with the Nauka. As you mentioned, the International Space Station was able to use some of its own thrusters to either slow that turn or to, you know, bring it back to where it should be. But I never even thought, and this is just a crazy thought, you know, when cryptocurrencies came out and the underlying technology of blockchain, they all said blockchain can never be hacked. And people say, well, NASA could never be hacked because they take all these great measures. What if NASA was hacked?
Well, that's something you're asking me a case of first impression question. I have never really thought of that before. I guess the rule of thumb is if it exists in the virtual world, it is hackable. We have not yet established the perfect unhackable system. If NASA were hacked, I imagine hackers could do all manner of terrible mischief if they wanted to. Similarly, the Russian space program, the Roscosmos, similarly the European Space Agency. If this happened, I think the mischief would be made less with civilian crew than it would be with military assets, with military satellites, particularly surveillance satellites. And there's much concern already about satellite wars, about so-called kinetic kill vehicles, satellites that could either fire projectiles at other satellites or missiles from the ground that could be fired. That technology does exist. There's also concern about blinding satellites with laser bursts. So there's a real fear of it's not human-to-human space combat, but machine-to-machine space combat. And whether we agree or disagree with the fact that that the U.S. really does need a sixth branch of the military, the Space Force, clearly the Space Command under the aegis of the Air Force is already at work trying to defend the country against this kind of thing.
And anything that could happen here on Earth is just demonstrably more complex in space. Space is hard. Space is dangerous. Just a month later, on September 9th, smoke alarms went off on the International Space Station. A small and brief electrical—I don't know if you call it an electrical fire—but did it. You know, they could smell the plastic that was burning, and I'm not sure if they ever figured that out. How that happened.
I don't think they did. And yeah, this was not quite a fire. I think we would call it an electrical smolder. But anytime you have any kind of fire taking place or anything close to a fire taking place in the enclosed environment of the space station or any other spacecraft, it is a critically dangerous situation to be in. And, you know, there's a reason the crew drills so exhaustively for those kinds of accidents. And the real danger comes from batteries aboard the spacecraft. I know when the Inspiration crew just flew, they trained for all manner of fire contingencies. And one of their concerns was the spacecraft has its own batteries. The tablets that the crew carried have their own batteries. The smartphones the crew had their own batteries, and batteries can overheat and burn. So this does present a real and manifest risk in space.
This book is so incredibly researched because of your background and what you do for Time Magazine. As you researched this book, what most surprised you?
I think what most surprised me was my experiences in Russia. And I think what surprised me the most was the reverence the Russians have for their own space history. Yuri Gagarin is more than just a legendary figure. He is an almost religiously revered icon in Russia. There are statues, there are wall murals, there are mosaics, there are stamps, there are posters, there are mugs, there are cups, there are t-shirts. If it's possible to put a human face on it, Gagarin's face is on it. The U.S. had its own Yuri Gagarins. We had John Glenn, we had Al Shepard. We have Neil Armstrong, for goodness sake, the first human being on the surface of the moon. And while everyone knows Gagarin's or Armstrong's name and face, he hasn't been turned into this kind of cultural icon that Gagarin is. And I think this speaks to Russia's deep reverence for its period of social or of geopolitical power and its period of geopolitical primacy, when not only was it the equal of the U.S., but at least in terms of space, it was the superior of the U.S. What also struck me, I think, was the peaceable way the Russians revere their space history. This is the first spacecraft may have been launched on military rockets, but this really seems to be almost a peaceable secular religion in Russia when it comes to Gagarin and when it comes to that reverence for the early days of the space program. I spent a fair bit of time in Russia, both doing work for Time and doing research on this book, and all of it sort of, you know, infused me with this sense of how they see their space history.
And Artemis, who's the twin sister of Apollo, the Artemis program is hopefully going to scheduled to launch and to land a woman on the planet, is an entire program that includes a base on the moon, a space station that will circle the moon. What are your thoughts on Artemis and some of these other wonderful programs going forward, including the inclusion now of these billionaires who are making all of this so exciting?
I am a wild enthusiast for the Artemis program. I think the goal of landing on the moon by 2024 will not be met. NASA has quietly retired that number, and it was never a realistic number. It was more of a politically motivated number. It was promulgated during the first and the only term of the Trump administration, and it was meant to coincide with the end of his second term in office. Whatever we might think of Donald Trump and whatever we might think of his administration, it was the administration that got the Artemis program on track and, you know, re-energized the U.S. commitment to the moon. So I'm a huge enthusiast for the Artemis program. I think when we talk about billionaires in space, we need to distinguish a little bit which billionaires we're talking about. Bezos and Branson have their own space companies, but these companies are not, at least what they've done so far with crewed vehicles, with, you know, peopled vehicles, are meant only for space tourism, for 15-minute popgun flights with a few minutes of zero-G and sightseeing, and that's it. Elon Musk and Jared Isaacman strike me as a more formidable pair. SpaceX has done extraordinary things and continues to do extraordinary things with its Falcon 9 rocket, with its Falcon Heavy, with the Falcon Super Heavy and the Starship spacecraft, which is now, it's currently in development. And Isaacman's Inspiration 4 mission, while he doesn't own a space company, while he didn't build the spacecraft, he did fly and command a civilian mission that was in space for a full 3 days, a full 72 hours. And I think that is a more signaled achievement than these suborbital lob shots have been so far. All of them are commercializing and in some senses democratizing space, but I am more impressed so far with what Isaacman and Musk have done than I am with Branson and Bezos.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. A final question for you, Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. You are a a curious person, to say the least. And you've written about space, human behavior, climate, medicine. What one question in the scientific realm, you can pick any topic you want, what one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
I guess the one question I would like to have answered that hasn't been answered yet would go back to space. And my question would be, how many universes are there exactly? A former colleague of mine at Time, who has since moved on to the New York Times, terrific writer, young woman named Elizabeth Diaz, and I wrote a piece that never wound up appearing in Time on the multiverse, the idea that there is more than one universe out there. According to some models, the number of universes out there is the equivalent of 1 to the 500th power, which is effectively an infinite number of universes. According to other models, there literally are an infinite number of universes out there, and an infinite number of universes means an infinite number of possibilities within those universes. As Elizabeth wrote in one of her best lines in our story, she wrote that a multiverse, an infinite number of universes, means there could be a duplicate Earth out there, except with one more mosquito or one fewer raindrop, which I very much liked. So I'd be interested in seeing and learning more about multiverse theory. And I think as time goes on and cosmology matures, we are going to learn more about whether there are other universes out there in addition to ours.
And relativity is a body of work that is very solid, and so is quantum. And right. The only way you can reconcile those two is through string theory or through different iterations of string theory, which brings the multiverse in. So there must be something there, right, Jeffrey?
Exactly. That's what I think, and I'm trying to learn more about it.
Jeffrey Kluger has written a page turner. It's a thriller, space thriller. It's titled Holdout. Jeffrey, we wish you continued success with your book. It's getting a lot of buzz. And we thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.